Hi, it's Jonathan, and this week I have been stuck in the library for a week and a half.
And I'm Naz, and I'm swamped this week, so we have a special edition of The Gender Knot, the podcast where we untangle the new masculinity and femininity. We're your hosts. I'm Naz Trentavakoli-Farr, or Naz in short.
And I'm Jonathan Freeman.
So if you're new to the podcast, welcome. This is The Gender Knot. Each week we take a dilemma regarding gender and we see if we can untangle it a little bit, shed some light on it, maybe even come to a solution. I'm Naz. I'm a journalist based in London, and Jonathan is in DC, and I understand you're outside the library as you finish your doctoral thesis.
I just finished a week and a half kind of marathon. I took a week off of work, quote unquote, and worked my other job, which is being a doctoral student, and I am experiencing a brief moment of outsideness before I get in my car.
So this week, Jonathan is stuck in the library, I'm swamped, and Sam and Johnny, our co-producers, are also swamped. So we thought we'd do something different this week. For a while, I've been really wanting to play you guys an episode of a podcast we really love called Ministry of Ideas. It's from Harvard Divinity School. They have a specific episode that I feel is really interesting. It's about race in the US, but there are lots of threads which I often think about when having discussions when doing this podcast. So we thought it would be a nice week to play you that, and then you'll also hear a really cool new podcast that some of you might be into. So we're going to come to that in a bit. First, a little bit of housekeeping. We have Gender Knot t-shirts. We've linked to them in the show notes.
And if you can leave a review, subscribe, spread the word. We really love hearing from everybody.
And do write to us. We've been getting lots of your thoughts via email. So that's thegenderknot@gmail.com. Also, you can go to our site, thegenderknot.com, and send a message that way. So we've been getting lots of interesting thoughts from you all. And I actually wanted to read one of them out. If we do want to read them out on the show, we will ask you beforehand if you're okay with that. So we had an email recently from Malcolm from London. So he said that he's listened to a few episodes of our podcast since we were in the FT, and he said that, "I'm dismayed at the overall impression that comes through in the episodes I've heard so far, that men are essentially inferior to women. I believe in gender equality." And then he talked about how he'd finished watching a report on the rescue of the boys' football team in Thailand. They were stuck in a cave, and he said that a man died in the process of saving them, and then every other rescuer had to make that hellish journey back and forth, knowing it could kill them. But these perfectly ordinary men did it. One died, and several others risked their lives to save these boys. And these were not military people or emergency service people. They were ordinary men.
Let me pause you there, because I feel it's really important to point out that they were actually special emergency service people, and they were military people. So, Malcolm, you need to work on some of your facts.
Also, Malcolm said that he works on a charity phone helpline that mostly deals with fathers who need help maintaining relationships with their children after divorce and separation. And he says, "I can promise you men are nothing like the way they're typically portrayed, including on your podcast so far."
Bravo for doing charity work. It's great that anybody does that. But I mean, I think the reason why we talk about toxic masculinity so much on this podcast is because it is a problem. It's sort of the old adage, you know, if it bleeds, it sells, or whatever it is. You could tell me the journalistic sort of ragtag thing.
I don't know what that is.
You know, it's the whole thing about, you know, it's like, you know, the bloody murder or whatever it is that's on the front page is what sells, and, you know, good news never, you know, it's like relegated to page 12, you know, below the line. And so, I mean, I think that's why we tend to talk about toxic masculinity, is that it's becoming more and more recognized as problematic, both for men and for women. There's very few men there's really no men that I know of who, like, striving to have a toxic masculinity, but are affected by it. And I think we're all kind of trying to work through it. And I think as women have become more empowered and more aware of their own power, it has forced men in a good way, in a positive way, to have to reassess and reacclimate, you know, where we fit in that equality. We need to think about how we're having an impact on women. And that's one of the fun things I've appreciated and one of the things that I've grown through. So, Malcolm, I hope you stick with us.
My main point is that this podcast is largely about problems and issues and sort of dilemmas. So I don't really think we tend to sort of celebrate anyone per se. Yeah, I do feel it's like largely centered around problems. And there is something about this podcast where, and I don't know if it's right for me to raise this or not, but over the past few weeks, we've grown quite a bit and we're getting a lot of feedback, and that's great and stuff. But as the sort of female voice on this podcast, it can be really tricky because it's like, how do you raise issues to do with masculinity in a way whereby you're being honest about it, but you're also not putting men off and you're keeping them engaged enough? And that's something that is quite hard to grapple with as well. It's something that is kind of coming up increasingly, which doesn't mean that men who listen need to agree with everything I, for one, say or anything, but that is a very difficult position to be in, of like, yeah, let's be truthful about problems, but do it in a way that isn't going to put people off and is going to keep men engaged. Yeah, it is increasingly quite hard being in that position. So on to this week's episode. We are going to go back to men's groups soon. We heard about men's groups last week. Johnny Blackwell, one of our co-producers, went to a couple. So we're going to go back to the topic of men's groups because some of you have had some interesting thoughts and experiences. Also, Sam, our other co-producer, she and I are going to be looking at how women can negotiate better pay. And there will be another episode on male shame. Several of you have asked about that. That will be coming in August. And before we go to this week's episode, I wanted to do a bit of a plug about something I've done, non-gender not, but some of you might like it. So I just presented a documentary for the BBC about male friendships, and it was looking at why men crave friendships with each other and what gets in the way of men getting close. So that was a BBC radio documentary. We've linked to it in the notes to the show. If you're into the gender knot, you might be into that as well.
And let me shamelessly say, it's fabulous and brilliant.
We look at the Obama-Biden bromance.
There's a new book that somebody wrote that's sort of about...
about their bromance.
Kind of about their bromance. It's like a mystery novel or something like that. I just found the book. It's called Hope Never Dies, an Obama-Biden Mystery. It has actually been published. It looks hysterical. Anyway, the bromance
is it
continues.
A fiction?
It's a fiction. Yeah, it's a mystery book. It's but you got to see the cover. We got to put a link to the cover because it's Biden and Obama driving in a convertible and it's
into
kind
the
of
sunset.
Not quite. Anyway, I'll send you the cover. It's amazing.
So we've linked to that, a bit of shameless plugging for me. But this week we're going to play an episode of Ministry of Ideas. It's this fantastic podcast out of Harvard Divinity School. It's an initiative of their religious literacy program. So the episode we're going to play you, it's called White Balance, and it's about race in America. And specifically, it's about understanding how race in the US involves understanding its relationship with class. Now, I really love this podcast, and in particular this episode, because I feel like every time I listen to it, all these things come up to me that are kind of often parallels to conversations we have about gender equality. And I don't want to say that, like, you can always look at race issues and translate them to gender issues, because that's not always the case. But sometimes they're sort of interesting threads or interesting sort of parallels that really can get you thinking. So I feel like this episode really does that. There's one bit that's especially powerful every time I've listened to it, and it's with the poet, writer, and English professor, Dr. Joshua Bennett, the part where he talks about the dominant group, the way that they don't have to look at their identity, how there is an inherent violence, and about, you know, being nothing when you don't have a story, when you're the, you know, the dominant group. I don't know, every time I listen to that, it really gives me chills. It's so, so powerful. So we'll be back with more from the Gender Knot next week. We're going to leave you with Ministry of Ideas for this week.
Near the end of his life, the American civil rights leader, Martin Luther King Jr., began thinking more deeply about poverty. King started to wonder why, even with significant advancements in civil rights, blacks continued to struggle to achieve financial independence and gainful employment. King ultimately concluded that racial divisions were keeping America's poor and working classes from uniting to demand a more just economy. In May 1967, King told his closest followers that we have moved from the era of civil rights to the era of human rights. There must be a radical redistribution of economic and political power. Soon after, he announced the Poor People's Campaign, an effort to organize poor people of all races to march on Washington and ask for better access to housing, jobs, and education. In a 1968 address to the Southern Christian Leadership Council, he expressed his vision.
And power for poor people will really mean having the ability, the togetherness, the assertiveness, and the aggressiveness to make the power structure of this nation say yes when they may be desirous of saying no. And it is my hope that we will get together and be together and really stand up to gain power for poor people, black people, Mexican Americans, American Indians, Puerto Ricans, Appalachian whites, all working together to solve the problem of poverty.
King began to travel around the country to build support for the Poor People's Campaign. On April 3, 1968, he traveled to Memphis, Tennessee, to lend his voice to a strike by the city's sanitation workers, who for years had suffered from low pay and dangerous working conditions. The immediate spark for the strike was the death of two workers who had been crushed to death by garbage compactors. That evening, he gave a speech at Mason Temple Church, where he called for the poor and working class of every race to unite.
Whenever Pharaoh wanted to prolong the period of slavery in Egypt, he had a favorite formula for doing it. What was that? He kept the slaves fighting among themselves. But whenever the slaves get together, something happens in Pharaoh's court, and he cannot hold the slaves in slavery. When the slaves get together, that's the beginning of getting out of slavery.
It turned out to be King's final public address. He was assassinated the following day. This is Ministry of Ideas, a podcast about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Zachary Davis. Today on the podcast, we're looking at race, class, and the American dream. What it means to be white in a world that's anything but. 50 years after his death, King's vision of a multiracial coalition of the poor and working class remains unfulfilled. Race continues to be a wedge preventing greater political solidarity between poor whites and poor people of color. The 2016 presidential election offers stark evidence of this. 67% of non-college-educated whites voted for Donald Trump, while more than 88% of non-college-educated blacks voted for Hillary Clinton. Why has a multiracial coalition of the working class remained so elusive?
I think it's part of the only way we understand it, is the invention of whiteness.
This is Joshua Bennett, a member of the Harvard University Society of Fellows and an award-winning poet. He thinks that the idea of whiteness blinds poor whites from voting for their best interests.
I think you could very well talk about sort of wealthy white elites, right? And how the way whiteness functions is actually to make sure poor white people never understand that their best class interests are actually aligned with the black and Latino people they're taught to hate on the basis of race, right? That the idea is, even if I'm poor, at least I'm not black, right? And what that does is you think you're being given a sort of sliver of the pie when you're not even in the room.
Whiteness is a term that captures the visible and invisible benefits that come with being a European American in the United States. The term first started being used in the 1680s in colonial Virginia. Many European immigrants came over to America as indentured servants, agreeing to work for a certain number of years before being granted freedom. They often worked in the same tobacco field side by side with African slaves. Both were treated cruelly, controlled by the same masters and lashed by the same whips. But the African slaves and European indentured servants began to fight back together. In 1676, white bondsmen and black slaves met secretly to plot an armed uprising and demand freedom. They marched together on Jamestown, torched the city, and forced the royal governor back to England. The rebellion terrified the ruling landowners. They recognized the danger to their position if all members of the underclass banded together. They responded by deliberately seeking to foster racial contempt between black and white laborers. They started giving preferential treatment to whites, allowing them to direct affairs in the field, join the militia, and carry firearms. Wealthy landowners and their brethren began speaking more deliberately about a white race. The Commonwealth's governing House of Burgesses passed the Virginia Slave Codes of 1705, stripping blacks of many rights they had previously had, and effectively legalizing white supremacy. The landowners used racism as a device to maintain economic control. Although initially only applied to British Protestants, over the decades and centuries, the status of whiteness was gradually granted to new immigrant groups previously denied the label, including the Irish, Italians, Mormons, and Jews. But at its root, whiteness has always been about staying on top of a social hierarchy based on the color of one's skin.
Yeah, I'm a very, lucky guy. I got a lot going for me. I'm healthy. I'm relatively young. I'm white, which thank God for that shit, boy. That is a huge leg up. Are you kidding me? Oh, God, I love being white. I really do.
This is the comedian Louis C.K.'s take on whiteness from a stand-up performance in 2008.
Seriously, if you're not white, you're missing out because this shit is thoroughly good. But let me be clear, by the way. I'm not saying that white people are better. I'm saying that being white is clearly better. Who could even argue? If it was an option, I would re-up every year. Oh, yeah, I'll take white again. Absolutely. I've been enjoying that. I'm going to stick with white. Thank you. Here's how great it is to be white. I could get in a time machine and go to any time, and it would be fucking awesome when I get there.
It's important to think about the relationship of this election to whiteness.
That's Julian Borg, an associate professor of history at Boston College. Borg believes that at least some of the support for Donald Trump is a result of the anxiety felt by many whites about losing long-held economic and political power.
Part of the politics of whiteness has to do with the loss of privilege, and that what may be new to some white people has been experienced in many quarters for many decades and centuries by other parts of the American population.
The percentage of the white population in the U.S. has fallen from 80% in 1980 to 62% in 2014. In the same time frame, African American, Latino, and Asian American populations have grown. These trends are only expected to continue. But it's not just demographic changes that are worrying whites.
I always want to remind people, middle-class people, that we can't equate class privilege with white privilege. Today, in American society, like 42.5% of people living below the poverty line are white.
This is Nancy Eisenberg, a professor of history at Louisiana State University and author of the book White Trash, which looks at the long history of white poverty in America. She explains that the idea of whiteness is deeply entwined with the American dream of being able to move up the social ladder. It's also a dream that is increasingly out of reach for lower-income whites.
We tell ourselves these stories because we want to believe that Americans have always believed in social equality, that this is the land of opportunity. But the facts just don't back it up.
Unemployment, wage stagnation, family breakup, drug addiction, these are common features in many poor white communities today. And these challenges are prompting many whites to ask themselves, what does it mean to be white in America in 2017? What makes answering this question so hard for some is that whiteness was constructed as a neutral quality, merely a blank canvas. Joshua Bennett discusses the danger of this belief.
The philosopher George Yancey writes about this so powerfully. He says that whiteness is exclusive transcendence, right? You're taught that you're just an individual, but you have no body. You're just ideas, right? And I think that's an incredible violence. When I talk to children and teach workshops for middle school kids, I just start with narrative, right? And so often, especially for my white students, they'll say, well, I don't have a story, right? They'll say, I'm normal, I'm nothing. I'm like, how could you be nothing?
Julian Borg shared a similar story.
There was a first year student last year and as in a class, and as people went around the room and talked about who they were and where they came from, part of their identities were I am Filipino-American or African-American. And it came around to a white student who said, I'm just white.
That strange feeling that whites have that they are nothing is a problem. It's a problem because it's actually another way of feeling that whites are everything. Or in other words, that whiteness is the default, universal perspective of humanity, and everyone else is in some ways a deviation from that universal standard. Recent events in 2017 show how this often unconscious belief in white universality can warp into a dangerous assertion of imagined white superiority. At a rally in Charlottesville, Virginia this August, white nationalists sought to prevent the town from removing a statue erected in honor of the Confederate General Robert E. Lee. On a boiling southern afternoon, the protest turned violent, and a white supremacist mowed down dozens of counter-protesters with his car, killing a young paralegal and injuring many others.
You will not replace us!
There's a striking example from modern technology that shows how damaging the assumption of a white default can be. In early photography, black furniture and black people wouldn't show up in the final picture, as the image always lacked the proper light. The development of what we now call white balance, a way of balancing light color in a frame, was centered around color correcting to a woman photographic experts know as Shirley, a white woman wearing black and white in front of a gray background. White was considered normal, and other skin tone couldn't hold up to the glare of the camera lens. It wasn't until Kodak was forced by corporate clients like chocolate companies to better rationalize color film for darker shades that black and brown people began showing up naturally in standard film stock. The first step to a better meaning of whiteness, then, one not tied to being on top of a racial hierarchy, is to recognize that whiteness has a history. It is a history that has shifted and evolved over many centuries. And if we are to have any chance of achieving Martin Luther King's vision of a multiracial coalition that works on behalf of the poor, it will need to become a meaning that helps whites not see black and brown advancement as coming at their expense. During that last speech in Memphis, just hours before his death, Dr. King urged his audience to keep this hope of multiracial unity alive. It's a hope we should all have, and a dream we should all work for.
You heard a special edition of The Gender Knot, where we listened to the podcast Ministry of Ideas.
It was hosted by me. I'm Nasrin Tavakoli-Farr, or Naz in short.
And I'm Jonathan Freeman. Our co-producers are Sam Baker and Jonathan Blackwell.
We'll speak to you next week.
Take care.